Wolf's memoir of growing up in the Rainier Valley. I'm down. This is Weekday. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, KUOW.org. Growing up in the Rainier Valley, when you're white and most of the kids are black, who fits in, who doesn't? Mishna Wolf is an actress, comedian. She's written a memoir, her first book, I'm Down. And it's all true, right?
Yeah, pretty much all true, yeah.
I don't want to be like James. What's that? James?
James Frey.
Yeah.
James Frey, who like rewrote the book on memoir writing.
It's changed it for everybody, right? I was figuring your editors vetted you.
Yeah, I got legally vetted.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. That was a very fun process.
They came and they checked everything and they made you sign certain...
You know what? Actually, what they really do is they make you adjust your people so they're less recognizable, which is really strange as a writer. You try and make people as specific as possible and stuff like that. And they're like, ooh, we're worried about this person right here. Like, can you change his name and, you know.
So, really?
Yeah, bury that description that's very specific and that he'll definitely know makes it him.
Really?
Yeah.
So we take, to avoid being sued, we take the memoir and fictionalize it.
A little bit,
deliberately.
Yeah. It seems that, I mean, just there's certain
or
things they want.
Obscure it.
Obscure it a little bit, I think.
Huh.
Yeah, and I fought a lot on the obscuring.
By the way, I know people can't see this, but is this really a picture of you with a giant hairdo, or is some of this a
That is, I would say, 100% Photoshop.
100% Photoshop. I was really kind of hoping that was because you look like this charming, innocent girl with her hair probably as tall as her.
Yeah, the face is definitely me. That's my third grade school photo. But the hair is a creation of Photoshop.
Kind of a little Orphan Annie look.
Yeah, it is, kind of.
Well, and even the typeface, right? I'm down.
Oh, yeah. I never...
All right. Where'd you go to elementary school? Kimball?
I went to Kimball, yeah.
Where is Kimball?
Kimball's in the Beacon Hill area.
And... So how'd you get there? Bus?
No, there was this woman named Naomi who was like this.
Can you say all their real names now? Now I'm wondering.
No, she was really named Naomi. She was named Naomi and she was like 200 pounds, maybe 225. She was huge. We used to call her Fat Jehovah's Witness Naomi. Naomi took care of all these kids in the Rainier Valley. They were like, I mean, all black except for me and my sister. So we went to Fat Jehovah's Witness Naomi's house in the morning, like really early. And then 12 of us kids like make this exodus up to Kimball and various other schools. It was like almost like a taxi service on feet. And the oldest kid would lead all these kids up to their various schools.
Up what? So what are you, walking up Beacon Avenue or
No,
Jefferson?
We were walking up staircases because there's all these weird staircases in the Rainier Valley. So we'd walk up all these little staircases. And then after school, we'd come back to Fat Jehovah's Witness Naomi's house. And just...
That's an awfully long name to have to call someone.
Yeah, and we just sort of like... just get into awful games with each other and just call each other names and beat on each other until our parents picked us up.
Sounds like typical growing up.
Totally.
What games? What kind of awful games?
We would just play like really... there was this like slam charades where it was like charades, but you could talk. But then we would also like bust on each other in the middle of the charades. Like if you weren't doing a good charades job, you could get like berated about how stupid or retarded you were. And there was just like, there was always like games that weren't particularly nice.
Were you always the only white kid in the group?
It seemed like it. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were situations where I was not the only white kid.
Cause didn't even in that neighborhood in Kimball, it was sort of I won't call it a mixed neighborhood, but it was.
No, I mean, there were definitely white kids. Because I came from Fat Jehovah's Witness Naomi's house though, I had my crew and they weren't white. So even at Kimball, I was sort of disassociated from the white children there.
Oh, there were. I see. And was it?
Yeah, there were.
Was Kimball? So what is this? Late 80s? This is middle 80s, huh?
Yeah. And Kimball was, it was mixed. It was definitely, there were a lot of Asian kids there too at the time is what it was. There were quite a few Asian kids. So, but,
were you guys in cliques by then?
Were we in cliques?
You know, just Asian kids hung out with the Asian kids. Black kids and you hung out together? White kids hung out together?
I was definitely with the bad kids at Kimball.
Oh,
like, whatever it was, I was a behavioral problem.
So it didn't really matter for race.
It didn't really matter. I was in the back of the class.
You I'm not quite sure how old you are here. 6 years old, I think. Your dad was showing you a gun.
Yeah.
And then your mom wanted to talk to him about that.
Yeah, she had kind of an issue with
that. Yeah. And you walked outside and you walked around the block and you met a girl, Latifah.
Yeah.
And then you were talking about playing with her, but what happened? Her mom come out?
Her mom came out, and that was a moment where I didn't really, like, I had been called white before, but I didn't really understand that was a thing. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was like a joke, like white was like a joke. I remember it was like Latifah's mom, and she just looked at me in this way that let me know that, you know, because Latifah would get really weird around me when her mom was around, you know.
So you guys were friends?
Yeah, we were friends. We were friends on the block. We were friends, you know, most of the time. She was like one of the kids I was most friendly with on my block. But because there was like a gang on my block of kids.
Yeah.
And I just finally got it that her mom was not going to be okay with us playing together. And I didn't really, and I finally got that was like, that's what the white thing was. Like, it was like a thing.
That was weird.
It was totally weird.
Because you were with your dad and your dad was white and black. And
yeah, it just didn't, it seemed like ridiculous. It just seemed, it just seemed ridiculous.
What did Latifah think? Do you ever talk? I mean, how did she?
I mean, I think at the time she didn't. She thought it was ridiculous too, but she wasn't going to get in trouble. You know what I mean? She wasn't going to get in trouble over playing, you know, Foursquare or hopscotch with me or something like that. It wasn't worth it.
So what did that mean? That was it? You and Latifah and some of the other kids? You were ostracized for some of them?
No, it just meant we didn't play in front of our mom. I mean, it's you know, it just meant like we had to mind things a little bit. And there was, you know, there were a couple of scrapes like that where it was like, I can be your friend with this group of people, but I can't be your friend in front of my sister, or I can't be your friend in front of, you know, Jason, because he thinks I'm really cool and you're white, and that would really mess things up for me.
What? So looking back on this now,
right?
I mean, I know this book puts that into some context, but put it into some. I mean, how you feel about that? How you think about that now?
That's a hard thing to say.
I know, that's why I'm making you do it.
Jeez.
And you'll have the next 45 minutes to do it too.
To put it into some sort of context, you know.
All right, I'll let you wait.
Yeah, let me.
You were living there because your father moved back to the house he grew up in.
Right.
And why did he want to move back there?
I think he just him and my mom had just had me. They were on the East Coast, and he had done like sort of like a hippie move to the woods thing with my mom, and they moved back there because, you know, they could, and they had a kid, and, you know, his grandparents were in Seattle, so, you know, sort of made sense.
They were leaving that house.
They were leaving that.
Why were they leaving?
Because they had moved to the suburbs.
Why? Like,
why? What do you think? I mean, they had pretty much, you know, they were getting older and they had sort of enough with the city and all the stuff that brings. And, you know, they were, you know.
Well, why didn't they move to a home? I mean, were they moving to the suburbs because they didn't like, they were one of the last white families in the area, right?
They were. I mean, on my street, it was pretty much.
Not that I want to put your parents in a home or your grandparents in a home.
Right? No. They weren't moving to a home. Yeah. They were moving to, a quieter, nicer area, and, you know, in some ways, and, you know, they were holdouts on the street for sure.
What's your cross streets? I know you don't want to have us come to your house. So what are your cross streets? Where were you growing up?
It was right near, it was right around the triangle where Martin Luther King meets Rainier Avenue.
Right,
where the overpass is, near the Value Village and the Church's Chicken.
Yeah. And also, aren't we near where the...
We're near Franklin,
where the new light rails is going in.
I know, that's so, wow.
So what was that? Was that neighborhood in 1980? I remember that neighborhood. Was it particularly? Yeah. Was it a particularly noisy neighborhood? Unpleasant neighborhood? Loud neighborhood?
Not that I remember. I remember being at a whole heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember there was a there was a big abandoned lot that we thought was a junkyard, but it turns out someone owned it. And everyone would just dump their crap there. So there was all kinds of fun stuff there. And there was like a really great gang of kids. And there was a mini market called Emerald City that had awesome video games that you could play. And there was a Korean store next to it where you could look around at all this stuff that you'd never heard of before, like dried fish. And big, huge bags of rice and soaps that smelled really good. And there was Chubby and Tubby hardware store that had fun toys.
That was a good Chubby and Tubby.
Yeah. So, I mean, it didn't seem particularly bad or rough or anything like that.
Until, well, you live in New York now.
I live in New York.
So you can see some bad, rough neighborhoods if you want to, right?
Yeah, I can. I can.
No comparison.
No, I have to say that Seattle on a bad day can really compare to New York on a bad day.
It can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are scary, scary times and parts and places that I've been and seen in South Seattle, for sure.
And when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely.
That happened?
Absolutely. There were random acts of violence that sort of happened spontaneously. And, you know, and there were definitely scary moments.
Was race a factor in those scary moments or in your perception of them or in your parents' perception of them?
No, not for me at that time at all.
Did it come later?
I mean, that always seemed like class for whatever reason. That always seemed like class. It seemed like, you know, when money was scarce, people got desperate or, you know, it was about, you know, protecting respect, you know, someone's respect. So, no, it didn't particularly seem like it was about race.
By the way, did respect in the 80s and 90s mean that you had to fight? Physically fight people?
I mean, I certainly thought so. But I think my viewpoint has changed a little bit.
No, but back then?
Back then, yeah. But, I mean, I'm seeing this from a kid's perspective. From a kid's perspective, yeah, you absolutely had to fight if someone disrespected you.
And you did?
Yeah.
Did they respect you more after you did?
Yes. Absolutely.
Hence you were down.
Yeah, in the lamest, least possibly down. Like, if you have to say I'm down, like, probably not.
Mishta Wolf's memoir is I'm Down, but apparently probably not.
Probably not down.
We're going to talk more. You can find out about what she does and see some YouTube videos and other things at KUOW.org. She's reading at Elliott Bay Books tomorrow at 4:30.
And this conversation continues in a minute. 55 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. We expect a high of 72 this afternoon. Some clouds this morning, otherwise mostly sunny later. 919.
Support for KUOW comes from AdHost Internet, specializing in business website solutions since 1995, including e-commerce packages, web application development, and dedicated servers in downtown Seattle. Information online at AdHost, spelled AdHost.com.
94.9 KUOW News and Information. Of all the classic science movies, which ones actually got the science right? We'll find out today at noon on KUOW HD2 and 91.7 FM.
Support for KUOW comes from Centrum's Festival of American Fiddle Tunes, July 3rd and 4th in Port Townsend. Artistic director Dirk Powell welcomes traditional and roots musicians for concerts and dances at historic Fort Worden State Park. Details online at centrum.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. I'm Down by Mishta Wolf. It's her memoir of growing up in the Rainier Valley and looking at race in America. So maybe you have some thoughts and stories. We're going to get some more stories from her. We have, here's a little bit of tape, yeah? Yeah? A little bit of reading by Mishta Wolf from her book.
One, I wasn't the most articulate kid. In fact, if I needed to express myself, I would break something and hurt myself to get my point across. For example, breaking glass and getting cut meant I strongly disagree. And hitting a wall until I broke a knuckle meant you have a point, but you're not seeing the whole picture. And curling up into a ball in the fetal position and crying meant, this isn't over. But none of these devices seemed to work at government-subsidized charity club. When I hit a wall with my fist because someone said my mother was so buck-toothed she could eat corn on the cob through a fence, everyone just laughed at me harder. Plus, the counselors got pissed off at me for making them find the first aid kit.
Mischa Wolf talking about her life growing up in her memoir, I'm Down. Mischa Wolf was an actress and a writer. Comedian, I should call you.
I'm not really an actress.
Well, it says actress right there.
I don't know who put that on.
People do. You're the actress. Mischa Wolf's sister's here, too. We're going to bring her in later. All right, how about this? Was one of the 2009 Sundance Screenwriting Lab fellows.
That would be me.
All right. What was that for?
Screenwriting?
Yeah. What were you writing?
I was adapting this book.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Is it done?
It's not done, the adaptation, no. No, it's actually, by all practical means, it should be. But it's not.
Who plays you?
Oh, who knows? Someone adorable.
Who plays your dad?
I don't know.
What would your dad, give us a picture of your dad. Sketch your dad out for us in that era, in the 80s.
God, you know who would be kind of, like, he was kind of a Josh Brolin looking guy. If he had more soul, like if Josh Brolin had a little more, you know, soul, then I feel like that would be sort of my dad.
Why did your dad have soul? I mean, is this description accurate? Her father wore a short perm, a Cosby-esque sweater, gold chains, and a Kangol, telling jokes like Red Fox and giving advice like Jesse Jackson.
Yes.
He was white, but he was down. That's in quotes.
Yes.
So was he down if it was in quotes?
Yeah, he was actually very down. Like, compared to me, who was like, the title's a little facetious. Compared to me, who struggled to be accepted in anything at any time, he was actually completely integrated.
He was. Why was that? Because he grew up there.
I think it's because he was cool. I think he was just kind of cooler than me. You know how some people are just cool? Like, I wasn't cool. He was, like, really cool.
All right. Well, you said your sister was cool.
She was definitely cool.
So, Honora, why were you cooler than your sister?
That's a hard question. I don't think I was cooler, but I think...
Did you feel out of place?
No.
In that neighborhood?
Not at all. Because I think I was just a ham.
A ham?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean you acted out?
I just had fun. Life was a party. I would run out and go, hello, my friends, and be well received. I was just goofy, I think, outgoing.
She was like that Mark. Wasn't that part of what I watched today? She was like Mark Antony, the other Mark Antony. That was your line, wasn't
it? Yeah, she was like Mark Antony.
Yep.
And you were just dorky and uptight?
Yeah, I would think I was just uptight and dorky. Yeah, that's a pretty good description. You know, if you have to ask whether or not people like you, they probably don't. No, I'm not saying that, but I definitely just struggled a lot with just, you know, what do I do here? People are acting like this. And, you know, I didn't know how to be myself.
Was race an issue for you, Honora?
No.
Did you see color, as Stephen Colbert says?
You know, at certain points I saw color and it shocked me as well. But for the most part, my friends would say things like, Honora, you're not a color. You're just Honora, you know? And I'd get that all the time.
But you didn't get that, Mischa?
No, I didn't get that. I got whitey. Yeah, no. I did not get that.
And did you see color back?
It was, you know, it took a while. It probably wasn't until I was like in third grade or so. Until I was in IPP. You know, which was the school I went to that was like...
Where was that school?
It was housed in a bunch of different schools. And it was basically like just like a bubble. It was like a bubble of 30 kids that you went to school with for however long.
Were they all white kids?
They were predominantly white.
That's the crack against the Seattle Public Schools advanced placement programs.
Yeah.
They're in integrated schools, but in name only.
Well, that might be, you know, yeah. I mean, it was a complete bubble at the time. That might be different today. I mean, that might be completely different today. And I think that while I was there, there was a lot of, There was a lot of root canal about that sort of thing. I mean, because I remember reporters coming to the school, and you know, it was. And then there was at one point there was like sort of an influx of minority kids into the program. So there was like sort of it was being criticized while I was there, you know, or like halfway through the program.
So did you stay in that program for how long?
I stayed in that program until I. Well, I don't want to get too far because there is another book after this. But I stayed in that program.
We will not remember.
I know.
We'll see
I know.
It come out, and we'll be very then
very surprised.
We'll be reminded. Oh, I heard that woman talking on the radio. I want to pick this book up.
Yeah, I mean, I stayed in the program through its end, pretty much. But
we could probably Google you and find out. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Garfield.
Yeah. How was Garfield?
I didn't do very well there.
Were you in the? What's the advanced? Is it APP?
Yeah, I was in the APP. It's still in Garfield, but I actually left there after 2 years.
Didn't like it?
No.
Why not?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons that I didn't like it, but mostly...
Well, in relation to the way whites and blacks relate,
no,
is that part of it?
No, in relation to the program, the way APP had been up till then, I mean, it was called IPP back then, but in relation to the way it had been, it was too social for me. Like, I didn't, you know, it was like... up until then, you knew what you were supposed to do. You were supposed to get A's. It was pretty simple. Everyone called you stupid if you didn't. And they, you know, you were with 30 kids that pounded on you if you said something stupid. So, and then I got to Garfield and there were like assemblies and there were like dances. And I was like, this is not for me. I just don't know how to do this.
All right. I don't want to put you on the spot, but were you in advanced placement as well?
I wasn't.
Yeah. And did you go to Garfield?
I did go to Garfield.
And were you in? So you were just in the mix of students in Garfield.
I loved it. I loved Garfield. I absolutely had a blast.
I mean, you're in this book.
Yes.
You appear in this book quite often.
Yes.
Often as the person who's having a good time, and then you have to be the foil for her stories.
I suppose. I suppose. Yeah. Or maybe the other way around.
When?
Maybe she's the foil to my story.
I know. But give me an example of when that occurred in the book, do you think?
You know, I feel like, I mean, there was this thing, too, when I started IPP where my dad really wanted me to still be connected with the neighborhood and with his friends and with, like, the friends I had before.
And who were his friends?
They were predominantly black people, you know, and they had kids and I was friends with their kids.
Yeah.
And then... you know, all the people I knew from Fat Jehovah's Witness Naomi's house and from the block and, you know. And also, I didn't feel like... He would tell me all the time I needed to be well-rounded. And he didn't feel like that school, that sort of classroom environment for me was well-rounded enough. So
what does that mean by well-rounded?
Well, I think now it means like... I mean, at the time, I felt like it meant, you know... cooler, like you have to be better at like other things besides school, or you know, you just have to. I don't know. I think it meant now I know. I think it meant like you got to be into things I'm into, otherwise we won't be able to relate to each other. But I think at the time I felt like it was, you know, sports and like, you know, getting on with people.
So it's about it was as much about being cool as about race.
Right. I mean, if you're asking what the book is about, I think it's just really a coming of age story, father daughter story, and it's set against this backdrop of race, you know. But the issues that come up in the book are actually very class related as well. Mostly, I would say class related because we were also exceedingly poor.
Yeah.
You know?
So, what's an example of that class related? Well, let's talk about what happened to your mom.
My mom actually, she was a bus driver at Metro. And when they split, my mom originally just got weekends. That was her thing. She got weekends and my dad got weekdays because she was working full time at Metro. And, you know, some of those shifts are like she would work like all night. She would work like 4 to 5 in the morning. And, you know, I think she had a little bit of her own stuff to deal with as well, having gone through a divorce or whatever. So,
And having found out that her husband was a little different than she had expected, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime someone gets divorced, it means like things didn't turn out the way I planned. And I have to look at the roadmap a little because I took a wrong turn somewhere.
Well, she went from hippie Maine, crunchy granola, I believe is how you described your dad, to
to
the man who emerged.
Yeah.
The Kangool cap wearing fellow.
Yeah, the guy who went and got perms.
Yeah. By the way, is he listening? Is he up yet?
He's probably up, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
I hope he calls in. He might want to weigh in on this.
Yeah, great. I'd love it.
And your mom, I mean, she could all weigh in.
Yeah. And then eventually she got more and more custody and, you know.
Well, you decided you wanted to go live there with her, right?
Yeah, at some point, yeah, I decided I wanted to go live with my mom.
Your coming of age story was that you were having a little trouble at the home your dad had set up.
Yeah, pretty much.
With your stepmom? Do you call that woman your stepmom? Yvonne?
I have a new stepmom now.
As well?
Yeah, yeah. I have a new stepmom. Her name's Linda. She's also African-American. She's a fantastic lady. You know, I mean, the thing about this memoir, and I think the thing that made it possible for me to write it actually now, is that everyone's changed an awful lot. You know, I would say a lot of the people are not the same people they were when I was that age. You know, they've grown. They've actually grown. And it's a snapshot of a time, you know, in Seattle, in my life, in my relationships with my family, where everyone was in this place that was like really in flux, you know, and they were, people were confused, you know, they didn't know how to act or they were doing the best they could, you know, but it's just, you know, that period, you know, and it was kind of a crossroads for a lot of people, not just me. I mean, it's a crossroads for me in the book, certainly, where I have to make some decisions about, you know, who do I want to be? You know, how do I want to live my life? You know, are these values my values? You know, what are my values? And, you know, what do I call home? And but it was also a time, you know, or shortly thereafter, where a lot of other people in my family made a lot of decisions. So, you know, it's a crossroads where everyone has gone off and, you know, sort of grown from in a lot of ways in my family.
Meeston Wolf has written a memoir about her, about that crossroads. It's called I'm Down. And we're also thought we'd get from you some of your own stories and your own experiences in this crossroads. Aaron's in Bothell. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for holding.
Oh, no problem.
So what's so kind of the flip side, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you grow up?
In an all-white suburb.
Of Bothell?
Actually outside of Chicago.
Ah. Oh, yeah? Which one?
Batavia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know where Fermi is?
Yeah.
So, yeah, because my dad worked at Fermi. And so I grew up there. All my friends were white, pretty much. Everyone in the neighborhood was white. And everything was cool until, yeah, about the third grade. Then suddenly people started noticing race. And so then, you know, but, you know, I mean, for me, it was normal. You know, these were the people that I grew up around. These were the people that I dealt with on a day-to-day basis. And then when I went off to college, I went to Hampton University in Virginia, which was a primarily black school, and suddenly to them I was white.
Because of the way you acted?
Because of the way I acted and the way I spoke. So I would go into people's houses and you'd hear from another room, who's the white kid you brought in with you? Because they could hear my voice but they couldn't see me.
Why in third grade? What do you suppose is happening in third grade that people are all of a sudden starting to see color? And how did you notice that was happening?
I don't know what it is about the third grade that suddenly everyone, maybe it was that kind of point where people began being aware of it and understanding that there should be something there.
I see.
Basically, for me, I had a group of friends up until third grade who pretty much all evaporated.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, none of them would speak to me anymore. None of them would hang out with me anymore. And so then I kind of created a new circle of friends post-third grade.
Mostly white kids, all white kids as well, I imagine.
Yeah, pretty much. There were a couple of black kids in our neighborhood as I started getting older. But yeah, pretty much everybody I hung out with was white.
How odd. How interesting. America's such an interestingly weird place. Did that happen to you, Honora? I mean, at third grade, did it?
No. No. I hung out with black people.
But it never. But I mean, there was never third grade. Nobody said they just saw you as an orange race.
I think I was so down that I used to get, what are you mixed with? Yeah. So, yeah, it was never a problem.
Yeah, she used to get that.
And
a lot.
I got confused because so many people would ask me that I was like, what am I mixed with? Huh. So.
You never got that.
No, I never got asked if I was mixed with something.
Hey, Aaron, did you ever get asked that? Or did
What was I mixed with?
Yeah, that never that doesn't ever count, right? If you're black, that doesn't matter in the questioning.
Right, it never really came up.
Hey, so where do you live now? You live in Bothell now.
Bothell.
What's that like?
It's kind of more of the same. You know, I come across a black person maybe once every 6 months or so.
but in terms of your comfort and where you live, you're happy.
I'm perfectly fine with it.
Yeah.
I'm perfectly fine with it. My sister, who lives not far from here, I think is a little less okay with it than I am.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
She feels like what? That she should be living somewhere else or people should get a clue?
That's a good question. I know that when she first came out here, she lived in Bellingham for a while, and she was like, people need to get a clue. 50.
Yeah.
But, you know, she came down here, and I don't know. We've kind of always been different in that way.
Yeah, well, here we're finding that out with siblings here, too, as well, aren't we? Aaron, I appreciate your call. Thank you and your story, because you guys are different. Didn't you have other siblings, too? You had half siblings.
We had stepbrothers and sisters. Our family, like, swelled and then contracted again.
Do you see those half-brothers and sisters?
I don't. No. And, you know, it's something that never really resolved itself that much.
Well, it doesn't sound like a very fun time, if I
may
say so.
It was not a very fun time.
You and Yvonne and your dad did not all see eye to eye, it seems.
No, we didn't. But in retrospect, I do see everyone's perspective, you know, and that's the weird thing.
What was Yvonne's perspective?
Yvonne
was the woman that your dad was living with at the time.
I don't want to give away too much of the book, but I mean, because this is like, I mean, I can see the perspective is the end of the book.
Well, then make something up.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think she was doing the best she could. I think she was working extremely hard to not only improve her station in her life, because she was, you know, really, she was an ambitious, driven, very smart, you know, a very hardworking person, you know, and I think that was her perspective. And I think she was struggling with someone who was a lot less ambitious than her.
Your dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she was worried that you were not pulling your weight.
Yeah, she was worried I wasn't pulling my weight. And I, you know what? I wasn't. I'm not going to lie. I was like, it was a power struggle, certainly.
You were 14, however.
I was 14.
Yeah. Mishta Wolf's memoir is I'm Down. She's reading at Elliott Bay at 4:30 tomorrow.
And this conversation continues in a minute. This financial recession is giving some people an excuse to finally hike the Appalachian Trail. Not the one in Argentina, the one that runs through the eastern United States. We'll talk to some folks who are out of a job and on the trail tomorrow morning at 7. KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
Support for KUOW comes from SME Electrical Contractors, serving homeowners and businesses since 1972 with electrical solutions to jobs large and small. 24-hour emergency service. More at smeincofseattle.com. We're at your service.
Yeah, there's a company in Birmingham that's defying the odds by using loneliness, nostalgia, and a bad economy to their advantage. More about that company and how they're doing it tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from the attorneys and staff of Stoll Reeves, providing legal assistance to companies in the renewable energy sector around the globe. Downloadable legal guides on wind, biofuels, geothermal, and other alternative energies are available at stoel.com.
57 degrees, partly cloudy in Seattle. We expect a high of 72 this afternoon. Some clouds this morning, otherwise mostly sunny later today. Overnight, a low of 52, clear skies. And the forecast for tomorrow, Saturday, a high of 76 and mostly sunny. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:40.
I'm Steve Scher. It's weekday. Mishna Wolf will read from I'm Down at Elliott Bay Books tomorrow, June 27th at 4:30. Not 7:30 like the Times said, 4:30. Mishna Wolf grew up in Seattle's Rainier Valley in the early 80s. Her father returned to the Rainier Valley from Maine, where he'd been living with his wife and his young daughter, and shed his long hair and his hippiness and adopted his real self emerged, the person he had been when he grew up, in the 60s, 70s?
Yes, I would say mostly 70s, and he was an athlete, so.
He was an athlete. What high school did he go to?
He went to Rainier Beach, and he went to Franklin.
And his friends were mostly other black guys. And he felt comfortable with them. He was part of their
Very much a part of black community. In fact, I think he's still a Royal Esquire. Maybe not. But that's a black men's club in South Seattle.
Yeah. Now, he doesn't say, I'm a black man.
No, it doesn't need to be said.
He is a black man.
For all practical purposes, that's his.
So what does that tell you about the way we put people in categories and identify people? Does that liberate you from that? Or does that make you feel... Untethered?
I think that the book in general and the subject is actually not about being tethered or categorized. It's about being untethered. I mean, after civil rights and with the invention of credit, you know, class and race sort of became these really malleable, liquid, sort of abstract things that were much less fixed and much more mobile and much more fluid.
Than
they had ever been before.
But not in our sort of media and mediatized constrictions and our constructions of how we look at one another.
Right, right. But also people didn't know how to act.
Because of that.
Yeah. People didn't know how to be, you know. People didn't know anymore. Like, before civil rights, I'm sure, like, this was black and this was white and this was poor and this was rich. And if you were rich, you dressed like this. If you were poor, you dressed like that. You drove this kind of car if you were rich, you know. Everything was marketed, like, perfectly because I think, I mean, I'm speculating, too. Things might have been exactly the same before civil rights. I mean, very fluid even then, but I think much, much less so. And we were dealing with a situation that's like after the Summer of Love. It's after the sort of hippie generation. It's in Reaganomics. It's like after that. And everyone's got credits, sort of, you know, and there's really no definition. I mean, I went to this school. Everyone was white in my class and they wore like ripped jeans. And I couldn't understand why rich people would wear ripped jeans. It just made no sense to me. I mean, that was baffling. I could not figure it out.
Which brings me, before I go back to the phone calls, to Michael Jackson.
Oh, boy.
Because I guess Michael Jackson, you just described Michael Jackson's own sort of journey and his own sort of, whatever that would be, search, quest.
Quest. I think
untetheredness.
I think he had a really difficult one.
You were a fan growing up?
Oh, yeah. Who wasn't a fan of Michael Jackson in the 80s and even the early 90s?
Well, older people.
Older people were not a fan. No, I had a picture of Michael Jackson on my wall. It was a poster. I kissed it every night before bed.
Really?
Oh, yes. I kissed Michael goodnight.
What album was that from? Where are we at there?
Thriller.
That's from Thriller.
Yeah,
right?
That was from Thriller. And that was like before I had any crushes on any boy ever in school.
Did you try to dance like him?
Oh, my God. Yes. Did I ever?
You too?
She did.
She did.
She did. You were there doing the moonwalk?
Bust
the kick. The snap and the kick.
How did I do?
She did well.
How did you do? You didn't do it.
I did it.
Do you remember dancing? You don't remember dancing, Mishna?
I remember dancing.
I did the moonwalk and she did the kick.
Yeah.
Combined.
What's the kick?
You know, the sort of like, you're not coming.
Oh, when he kicks his leg out.
Now, baby.
And then you kick.
Yeah. And maybe there's a spin with it too. And then you sort of pull your cap down.
Yeah.
Even if you're not wearing
go
a cap.
Go in.
You bring your head down like you're
bring
pulling your cap down.
Bring it out. Yeah.
See, that was an interracial thing. Everybody was doing that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson bridged that gap for your generation.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. I think Michael Jackson bridged a lot of gaps.
So how did you look? So knowing who you were and growing up where you grew up, how did you look at him later as he became paler? And also did more of the cosmetic surgery, restructured himself in a way that to some of us looked like he was trying to deny who he was.
Well, I have a weird view on celebrity. And I really believe that we create our celebrities as a culture. You know, and I just like, I remember that movie Three Kings. Did you ever see the movie Three Kings?
With George Clooney?
Yeah, where he's got Marky Mark sort of tied up. I know we're not supposed to call him Marky Mark anymore.
No, he's Marky. He's not Marky Mark anymore.
Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg, please.
Yes. And he's asking him, what's the matter with your Michael Jackson? You know, what is the matter with your Michael Jackson? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like the king of pop. And he's like, yes, you know, he's sick. He's sick, and it's a sick country that makes him sick, thinks he needs to make himself white. And I kind of feel like, you know, what did we do to Michael that, you know, he got, I mean, I'm coming from an outside perspective, but the man seemed a little disturbed, I think we can say, and not particularly happy.
He did not seem happy. No. Bill, in Paulsbow, you grew up in L.A., huh?
That's right.
Right next, where'd you grow up? Oh, in South L.A.?
No. Altadena, which is just a little ways north of Pasadena, just between Pasadena and the mountain.
I know Altadena.
I do, too.
Do you?
Beautiful. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really fascinated by your conversation and also by the fact that you wrote a book, which I'm sort of in the process of beginning. I grew up next door to Rodney King.
Oh, that's great.
Pre or post? Yeah.
Well, I was 10 years old in 1968. He was born in 1965, so he was very little, and I was just a little bit older. His family were Jehovah's Witnesses, and mine became, well, it was just my mother, my sister, and I, and we became Jehovah's Witnesses, too. We went to the same congregation as them and played in the backyard together hours for hours every day and so forth and so on. But I'm white. And it was obviously a black neighborhood, like a project, but it was kind of a rundown tenement kind of a thing. And
yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was. It's actually gotten pretty gentrified. I've gone back not too long ago. I didn't recognize it, but in the 60s and 70s, or late 60s, early 70s, at the height of the civil rights thing, there were helicopters, over our house every weekend. If you're walking around, you'll probably get hit with a spotlight. And I busted, I was put on the spread on the sidewalk just like any other kid in the neighborhood if I looked suspicious or whatnot.
Well, that's good. Equal opportunity.
I suppose so.
What's
funny because I didn't really, I grew up, I had, a, my father was split when I was five and my mother was mentally ill. So we were on welfare and I was in a school that was mostly black kids, but I listening to your conversation, just and the title of your book being "Down," which is the pop culture kind of a term, it occurred to me that for my generation, the distinctions between race and how we behave and stuff weren't so much defined by the media and by culture and by MTV or DTV or whatever's going on now.
What were they defined by?
Well, they weren't. I think the true demarcation always goes back to money, to your economic class.
Yeah, that's what you guys were saying too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so too. I think it plays a much bigger factor in that stuff.
In the culture, in the larger culture.
I remember
In your interactions with people.
Ah.
Well, yeah, if all other things are equal, then you fall back on the visual, obvious differences. But, for instance, if I went into a job interview and a black guy went into it and we talked exactly the same, we dressed exactly the same, and the person interviewing us was white, then I'd have the edge. And I don't know if that's human nature or whatnot, but we tend to towards sameness. But I remember as being a poor kid, a poor neighborhood, all through sixth grade, up all through elementary school, I didn't really, it never dawned on me that my skin was a real factor.
Did that happen to you folks as well? Because you were in Rainier Valley and you called it a poor neighborhood. And I don't think of it as a poor neighborhood now in the way you grew up in a poor black neighborhood with your single father is how this book, the book's front piece says. Do you see Rainier Valley that way?
Not now.
Not now.
No.
But back then, in the 80s, mid-80s?
I mean, my world was like my block, really. So it was like, I don't know about any place in the Rainier Valley you had to drive to. But
now you go to Georgetown for a cappuccino.
Yeah, now you go to Georgetown for a cappuccino.
Or Columbia City, I mean.
Definitely.
Sorry.
I mean, we went to a Baptist church there called Powerhouse that was like so run down. I mean, it was just like, no one seemed to have that much money. But that could have also just been the people we knew. You know what I mean? But there was definitely not a feeling of like, there's plenty, you know what I mean? There was always, everyone had problems that $200 could solve.
Hey, Bill, I appreciate your call. I thank you for that. Let me fit a couple more in. Cliff Mass is off today, by the way, folks. Hence, we're not getting his weather forecast. Rich is on Queen Anne. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
What are you, you're an American Indian, huh?
Yeah, Spokane.
Spokane.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I have white skin. I'm bald, blue eyes, and my dad was the only one of his family who married a white lady, and so all of my cousins are Indian, you know.
Sure.
Like Sherman Alexie Indian, and you know we'd go over there, and we still do, you know, 3-4 times a year, and I wanted to be Indian, you know, I wanted to look like an Indian. I was the opposite of Michael Jackson. If I could have. You know, had some surgery done and got, you know, straight black hair and brown eyes. And
how is it today?
Oh, I'm fine with who I am. But one thing I do miss is that I miss Indians because there's not a lot of them around here. And when I do meet an Indian, I have to say, you know, I have to kind of like, you know, oh, you know, somehow make it like, make it known. You know?
Yeah, you have to tell your genealogy, huh?
Right, kind of. You know, I have to. You know, let it out. Like, if you're a quarter Indian and you know you grew up on the res, and then you can talk, right?
Oh, I see. Not having grown up on the res also takes. Did you?
I spent a lot of time there, so you know, like enough time to where when I was there, I was accepted as an Indian. So it was kind of strange when I was there. I was Indian, even though. You know, because who I was, my family.
You were surrounded, yeah.
So yeah, and you lived in a trailer house with no running water, with my, you know, with my six cousins, and you know, who always were, you know, who basically didn't like white people. You know, were prejudiced against white people, and so I was too. And you know, even though my mom was white, and then I'd come home to I lived in Tacoma. I grew up in Tacoma, and it was just.
Wow.
It was a kind of an odd thing, yeah. And
I bet night and day, huh?
It was. And my dad also worked for, he was an activist, and he did worked for a lot during the fishing rights in the Nisqually and the Puyallups. And so we'd go to the fish-ins, and then I'd have run-in with my elementary school friends because everybody in Tacoma was not down with.
Oh, right. You were on the other side. Hey,
I was on the other side, yeah.
Rich, I appreciate that call. What I wanted to ask you a question. Did you ever want to be darker?
I mean, I think up until I was like, I don't know, like 9 years old, I don't think I felt like it would definitely solve a lot. I mean, it would just be awesome if I was black.
You'd be able to play with your friends with their parents around.
It would just help. I just thought it would be helpful. I thought it would be really helpful. I don't even know. It just like, I also like, I felt like people would think I was cuter. Like, I didn't think I was a particularly cute kid.
I had this hairdo.
Yeah, I know.
It would have looked good.
Yeah, I had, like, stringy hair, and I was, like, I had really knobby knees and really pointy elbows, and I was just was not a kid you wanted to, you know, I wasn't, like, a cheek-squeezing kind of kid.
I think she was absolutely beautiful. But
did you ever want to make yourself? Well, you didn't have to. People just thought you were mixed.
People thought I was mixed, but I always wanted tan skin. I've always had been pale with dark hair, and I thought, wow, if I had golden skin, wouldn't that be beautiful?
A little bit darker, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you grew up in the Northwest, always under clouds, and you're pale.
Yeah. All right, let me one more call. Ed's and Ed, I don't really know where you are. It says south. So you may be south somewhere. You're south of where we are anyways, Ed.
Hey, I'm in South Park. I just wanted
South Park.
I think the book sounds wonderful, and I just want to, someone who lives in South Seattle, I just want to respond to something the author said earlier about crime in South Seattle. I've lived in Capitol Hill and other areas of the city, and I think a lot of times crimes comes from restless kids and intolerance, gay bashing in Capitol Hill, or, you know, the testosterone in the U District, or drugs in Belltown. And I feel quite safe in South Park. And I don't have any of that going on. Maybe because I'm Hispanic, but I feel safe here. I don't feel like it's as bad as in other parts of the city, which might be considered safe. safer by other people.
Do you face racism on Capitol Hill that a white person would face in South Park or wouldn't face?
Well, I think there's a lot of white people in South Park, but I think in general, because we have so many minorities here, they seem to be more tolerant or more welcoming. Whereas if you go to, I've been to other parts of the city that are like Ballard or even Capitol Hill, and I didn't feel that much at ease. I felt like I was out of place, and I think maybe some of it is class, or also the fact that there's sometimes youth too, if you're older or younger. But I just want to say that from a different perspective, I feel like South Seattle is safe, and I also have friends in White Center in South Seattle.
Well, how did you know? I know that Ed, you're responding to something Mishna said earlier, but how did you actually feel growing up? Did you feel that your neighborhood was safe?
No, I mean, I think that in Seattle during the 80s and early 90s, there were certain pockets in Seattle that were not safe. And they were not safe mostly because of crack. You know, it was mostly these little pockets where it's like, there's a crack house there, there's a crack house there, there's a crack house there. So these streets are like weird. You know what I mean? And it's not like, they just don't bring a great element. It's not like this neighborhood, this whole neighborhood is bad. It's like these four blocks are like not great.
Yeah. All right. What's our takeaway from this book? Besides do more swimming. You were on the swim team.
Do more swimming.
You guys were both on the swim team.
Yeah,
right?
we were both on the swim team. I think sort of coming of age story or memoir, it's like be yourself.
That was how your dad kept telling you.
And be okay with it.
And did you not know that he was saying that along the ways?
Yeah. I didn't really hear him. I didn't really know he was saying that, or I thought it was qualified. Like, you be you, as long as you're like me, be you, which is like, you are like me. So be you, because what you're being is not being you. Because if you were, you'd be acting the way I want you to.
So maybe it wasn't just the other members of your family growing up and changing. But you.
Yeah. Of course. Of course. I hope so.
It really was about you changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mishna Wolf. I was just going to say Honora, because I don't know if your last name is.
It's Wolf.
All right.
I'm married.
Her sister, who's in the book. And so I made you sit down and be a part of it. Mishna Wolf's memoir is I'm Down. She's reading from it tomorrow, June 27th at 4:30 at Elliott Bay Book Company. Thank you for your phone calls and your emails. You can find out more information and watch a routine of Mishna reading and talking. We have links at kuow.org. We'll review the news in about, 7 minutes. Sir?
Thank you, Steve. This weekend, the relationship between food and music, no, not light classical music with a candlelight dinner, or pizza with singing robotic animals. Here's a hint. One of the guests will be bad boy chef Anthony Bourdain. He'll be talking about working in New York back in the 1970s, serving 5-star meals to famous punk rockers. It's 3 Chords and the Truth and Lobster Bisque. Sunday night at 10.
Support for KUOW comes from Snohomish County PUD, providing a sustainable energy option to residential and business customers through the Planet Power Program. More on building a sustainable future with Snohomish County PUD's Planet Power Program online at snopud.com.
KUOW and Harlequin Productions present 60s Chicks, a musical celebrating the women, history, and music of the 1960s, now through July 19th at the State Theater in Olympia. For more information, visit our community events page at kuow.org.
Well, it's less than a week now until U.S. troops are scheduled to withdraw from cities and towns in Iraq. But a recent wave of bombings has raised questions about public safety there. So some questions. Will sectarian violence rise again? Are Iraqi security forces prepared? A panel of experts talks about all that and more this morning at 11:13. KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle. KUOW 1340 AM Tumwater.